This is a podcast from meow.net.
Meow!
Common Practice, a monthly podcast about the things people do. Things to do with creativity, collaboration, cultural democracy, and the commons.
I'm here today with Karen Pilkington. Karen and I sit on the board of an arts organisation, a community arts organisation down in Plymouth called Take Apart, and that's how we met. And I thought it would be really great to talk to Karen more about her work, her ways of working and being in the world. I always love what you've got to say in the board meetings, and we never really get a chance to meet outside of that, so this is a good excuse to do so. So Karen, hello, can you tell us where you're sat today before we launch into our conversation?
Oh, so I'm sat in my kitchen. I'm surrounded by two laptops, so I multitask. I do two part-time jobs that should be full-time jobs, and then some other stuff like stuck on the end of it, like many people nowadays, to be fair.
And so tell us more about your two jobs, your two part-time jobs.
Yeah, so the first one is during the pandemic. We are residents of an area in Plymouth. We've been here for 17 or 18 years. I started to get involved in like neighborhood meetings and things maybe about 10 years ago. And then during the pandemic, we did the mutual aid thing. So we were delivering food parcels and picking up prescriptions and collecting and delivering post for people who were shielding, and just started to realize how many people living in our local area don't have like a strong cohort of friends and families. We've got a lot of single people living around here. And so we, you know, cut a long story short, we moved into a derelict shop building that had been empty for over 5 years and started doing a kind of drop-in service. So basically we were on the direct drag route from many people's homes to the local co-op. So we basically opened the door and kind of accosted people as they walked past with a, hi, how are you? That sort of thing. That led to us developing a food larder. So there was quite a lot of free food during COVID, and we started to be a food distribution centre. And we've constituted now as a community benefit society. And we focus on a lot of art and creativity, a lot of stuff towards our local park, and a lot of really trying to build meaningful friendships and relationships within the area that we live. So that's a part-time job. It's a part-time job because myself and the other co-founder from the very beginning didn't want to be, so she used to joke and call me the Queen of Stoke, which is the area that we live in. And it just rang a whole load of alarm bells that, you know, there's some amazing community work that we, you know, steal ideas from all the time. But the stuff that we often see, it gets focused around one or two really remarkable people. And we just didn't feel that that was sustainable for us. So right from the very beginning, we wanted to democratize that process as much as we possibly could and have as many people on the ground connecting to local people as we possibly could. So when we got funding to fund some hours, everybody works super, super part-time. So I have 10 hours a week working in that job, but it is a it's a difficult balance to create, really.
It stretches beyond the 10 hours often.
And then because of that, I guess, to kind of focus that part-timeness and to not just get dragged into this work that I obviously love, you know, for financial reasons, it was necessary for me to get another part-time job. So I became interested in our local VCSE umbrella organization, got some funding. It was doing a project to see how health statutory and the VCSE kind of join up and collaborate together.
Can you say what VCSE is?
Sure. Voluntary community sector. Don't know what the E actually stands for. Something. Basically, what you call charities and community groups often in many areas means really large charities. So people like Age UK, in our area, like kind of Colebrook Housing is quite a large charity. Marie Curie Hospices, those kind of things. But actually in Plymouth, we have like lots and lots and lots of really small grassroots charities and community organisations and CICs. So really micro organisations. And it kind of provides a voice for them and also a place for them to get to know each other. And it's really big on building collaborative action. So this piece of work which POP are doing, so POP is Plymouth Octopus Project, so that's the VCSE organisation. They are looking at collaboration between health, statutory and small charities and groups. That is a really interesting thing for us to think about. Lots of crossovers with the work that I do in the community, because obviously we see health inequalities all the time, and thinking about how the community can be part of the solutions for those is quite an important thing that I think about a lot. But again, that's like a huge complex issue. So I'm tasked to build a network around that kind of collaboration across the city. And that means that, you know, how long is a ball of string? Mm-hmm. How big is your network? How many people are going to talk to about these things?
Amazing. Just going back to the Village Hub, isn't it? The first area of work, the 10 hours a week, that's not 10 hours. Can you, just rewinding a bit, can you say a bit about how that was set up and particularly around constituted as a community benefit society, what that means in terms of the sort of governance and staffing and funding, really?
Really nice. So we chose that as a model because, so we're actually a charitable community benefit society, but a community benefit society is designed to work like an old fashioned provident society. So you're owned by your members. And we wanted a structure that would mean that decisions would have to have that kind of extended community buy-in. And we were trying to figure out, I mean, we were really naive at the beginning. We didn't really know what we were doing. But we wanted the essence of our constitution to actually talk about the fact that we would vote on things together. So we are a cooperative. But we're not a cooperative that sells stuff, if you know what I mean.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's just being a really interesting way to think about how, instead of organizations revolving around maybe three or four key players, so we might still be doing charitable work, but very often you know you get the movers and the shakers and the charismatic people, and everybody kind of gravitates towards them, and they kind of increasingly hold it, and you end up holding a lot of power that way, because community members often go, oh, thank you so much for helping me out, you're amazing, you're wonderful, I couldn't possibly do what you do, yada yada yada. Yeah, so you get this kind of like power imbalance even when you never intended it to. So we were aware of that. We really didn't want that to happen. And so from the beginning, we have a board of directors. So at least half of those have lived experiences of like homelessness, poverty, ill health, neurodivergence, that kind of thing. And then we also have a staff membership. So the staff members are able to attend all the board meetings if they want to. Again, there's like collaborative decision making. It's been really tricky because sometimes it's much easier. So we've had a bit of a cry, you know, please can we have a boss kind of cry, just because we all work part time. And so it's tricky to try and get that consensus and that communication going. But actually forcing ourselves to go part-time has made that decision really clear. It's like, no, we can't have a boss because there isn't anybody who's got the hours available to sit there during all of the opening hours. So we're forced to think about these things differently. And that's been brilliant because we've seen people who were used to having a very kind of traditional structure in previous working lives, or people who have never worked but have got those kind of structures in mind. So we've been able to take people in quite a journey from those positions, like inching slowly towards this more cooperative way of working together. It hasn't been without pain, and we're definitely not at the end yet, but we're definitely inching towards the journey, and that feels like a big success.
Yeah, really, really important to learn about those processes. And I wonder if it's not too painful, if you could talk about some of the kind of teething problems or, you know, areas of discomfort in that journey.
Yeah, so a sense that because we're mixed, so we have one of our directors who's done this before in a business sense. So he's got like a teal type business. And he has put a lot of energy and effort into being, how can you do work without a boss kind of thing. And his organization are doing that quite successfully. One of the things that he said was, oh, we don't think it's going to work. We think you're going to need to have somebody who orchestrates this because the people that you're working with aren't professional enough. They're not qualified enough. They don't have this innate ability to work. And his organization is based around green energy. So they're all pretty techy. So that was like a, ooh, do we accept this? It's like, no, we don't accept this. So that was a really interesting difficulty. And then we also have, we really have to sense make a lot. We have to really go over things a lot in terms of checking out our understanding and checking out how other people understand us. So we tend to have much longer meetings. We tend to spend a lot, we've slowed right down. At the beginning, I think, when we were new and we were getting a little bit of funding and we got super excited, we said yes to everything, but that kind of created a sort of frenetic amount of activity. It actually felt like, well, this is just too much. We're going to literally burn out. So we've taken the pedal off the gas quite a lot, and we say it's actually more important how we do things than, you know, what we do. We're very fortunate to have core funding in that, so we're not like project-based funding. But even when we've got like project-based funding, we're very mindful to put that in at a pace that feels like the community are able to handle the pace. I think another key learning is, so really thinking deeply about each other's relational styles. So one of our team members has a diagnosis of being ADHD. That's severely impacted their life, so since they've been a child. And one of the things that were said to them through a lot of their adolescence and young adult life was that they were a weirdo. So we've got a board and a kind of way of working that says, I'm a weirdo. And then we're starting to bring out the things that make us really quirky. So I'm a weirdo because I tend to take over things. So, for example, I was holding a meeting last night and we had an agreed format of how that was going to run. There were like four or five facilitators and I just forget halfway through. So halfway through someone's facilitation, I just step up and carry on what I'm supposed to be doing. And then 3 o'clock in the morning, I go, oh no, what was I doing? So I'm a weirdo because I have got dictator tendencies that want to just take over the world. And it's not intentional, but it happens. So that kind of thing goes up on our board and it gets discussed and talked about, and it takes some of the edge out of working together. So we're not like offending each other all the time.
That's really interesting. Yeah. And that having building in time to do that collective reflecting and sharing is what I find the hardest in most situations, because we, like, you know, that significance of slowing down, taking your foot off the pedal is hard to do in practice, but obviously, you know, everyone would benefit, I'm sure, in the long run. Just going back to your funding model as well, or models, you say you've got core funding. Can you say a bit more about how that works and who that's from?
Yeah, so we started off with a £10,000 award for all. We applied for an awards for all grant, And that we got that. So when we moved into the disused shop, we were able to like get the lights fixed and get the Wi-Fi, if it, you know, started. And then we had a lot of volunteer help. And we started at the beginning paying us. So we paid us, myself and one other colleague, we paid each other a tiny bit for our work. Yeah. So it didn't include all of the hours we worked, but we wanted to kind of start as with some kind of intent that we couldn't do this for free forever. That bid led to another bid where we were successful in getting a year's funding from the National Lottery. And that was core funding. So that was to go towards establishing some core hours and then things like rent, Wi-Fi costs. Our building is super small, so our costs are pretty low. And we've also started to pay rent now. So at the beginning, it was rent free because it was in such a state. But as we've made the building look nicer, hey-ho, we have to pay rent. How fair is that?
But And is that rent off the council? Or
no, it's a private landlord. And he owns the flats above. And so he's quite pleased that we're down below. So we pay a pretty low rent, really, but we still pay rent. So that we did that for a year. And then we reapplied at the end of the year again to the National Lottery Community Fund. We had some really good advice because we initially went for 3 years and they just went, go for four, or somebody said, go for four. So we did. We kept the amount pretty low. So we fund for 68 hours a week and then we spread that across all of us. So that means that because we feel that we have to work two people at a time just because of the vulnerability of being there in a drop-in kind of space. And we were successful with that funding as well. So we've just come to the first year of that. So we've got another 3 years left. It's not ideal. I mean, having grant funding is not ideal because you feel the stress of the funders' needs. The National Lottery are very easy to work with. They're not intrusive at all. But I suppose the danger of that is that I think we're quite fortunate. We've got quite a good eye on like the legality of things. So we've worked really hard about our bookkeeping and making sure we send off our accounts to the accountant on time. Our finances are transparent. We put them on our website and we try and encourage as many people as possible to look at them. So that gives us a degree of accountability. And actual fact, that's been really helpful as a young organization because it just keeps us focused on the other things that you need to do to run an organization well. So as well as all the touchy-feely, lovely, good stuff that's happening, there needs to be this kind of robust processes in place. And so that's really helpful. And we started off with a management plan about how we would organize things like that. So how we would, you know, agree financial spending and stuff like that. It's quite a chunky document. Not everybody is into it because it is quite wordy. So we're just in the process now of starting to reevaluate some of our processes, developing like a card deck, if you like, so we can make a much more accessible way of helping people to understand the processes that we have to adhere to. So we've got like financial protocols. We've also got, because we have a community larder, we've got food and hygiene protocols as well. And it's like helping members of the community really understand this stuff in a way that they don't feel like patronized or like talked down to or as if they're back at school.
It's sort of exciting as well, I find, because it's making the behind the scenes more visible so people can understand how and why the space is the way it is, you know, how much time people have to put into things. And can you tell us a bit more as well about the space itself, about the empty shop that you've refashioned? You know, paint us the picture of where it is and what it's like and how it's used.
Oh, I should I should be in the space and I could kind of have a little tour for you. So so it's very small. It's a very small shop. It's set back from the road a little bit, which means we've got like or from the pavement a bit. So we've got this kind of covered over area. So we have We put out surplus food on that every night. We have like vegetables we always put out there, for example. And we've got like a kind of free bookshelf there that people can come and take. So that's a really nice, attractive way of people just going, oh, what on earth is this? And it feels like a really nice, gentle entry. And then when you come in the front door, we determined we didn't want to make it look like a doctor's surgery or any other council space. So we've actually toned it down a bit because I think we were making people sick because it was so bright. So myself and my friend, when we first started doing it, in our head, we had a concept which we called psychedelic old lady. So we imagined an old lady's living room with a psychedelic kind of palette to that. So we had a kind of paisley pattern on the wall, and we have like a tree that's growing up out from the corner. We've got like a fireplace painted on one of the walls, and a shelf and a clock and a little TV, and we've got some old granny furniture in there as well. So we try and made the space that it was a bit different. So when people came in, they didn't feel like, you know, this is just the official thing that I'm really used to. We've got a computer that people can use. We've got free Wi-Fi. And then we've got like the food larder itself inside. So we've got like a kind of corridor of shelving with like ambient food that people can come. We now run that as a co-op. So people become a member of the CBS for £1 forever. And then they can purchase items for 20p an item. We're loose, so sometimes if people can't afford it, they can't afford it, we would still give it. But actually, it's creating enough funds that it's probably going to be self-sustainable. So we pay like £2,000 a year to our local fair share to collect, to deliver that ambient food towards us. And then we have some volunteers who we like would pay petrol and support to go and collect from various places. But we can cover all of those costs through the funding with a little bit extra, which means that we can start to buy things for the shelves on the larder as well if we're really low. We're not a shop. We have to keep saying that to people because people, mm-hmm. the better we get at it, the more people think we're an actual shop. So we're not a shop. But it would mean that if anybody had no food in their cupboards for 2 or 3 days, they could come there and they could get kitted out enough to not feel that they were like really miserable. Where the computers are, we've got quite a flexible space, so we can fit in. If we fit 10 people in there, we are packed. We are having a party then. But we do quite a lot of arty stuff. So we do like, you know, crochet and like art paintings, and we have it's a nice discussion space because it's really small, so it makes you feel like it's kind of quite intimate. And then there's like you go through into what used to be our art room, which is effectively an overgrown corridor, and it's, if we can fix the hole in the ceiling because we had a leak for a while, it's where we would like to eventually put a kitchen. So we've got like a an air fryer and a electric pressure cooker. So we create soup once a week. And we've got some people who are interested in learning how to cook who don't cook. We just would like to fix we'd just like to tidy that space up a little bit more, because at the minute it's still clean, but because of the hole in the ceiling where the leak was, it's like, meh. It's not too kitcheny. And then we've got a tiny, tiny little kitchen area and an accessible toilet at the back. And then we have access into our courtyard garden. So that was a really disgusting minging space when we first moved in. But it's now got like quite a bit of artwork on the walls. It's got some poems that a local person was into that we blew up big. So there's some pictures of her big poems up there. It has we have like a gardening club once a week to come in and potter. And then we've extended, we kind of outgrew our space. So we extended out the back gate into the back lane, and we've started to grow down the back lane. So there's like bits and pieces down the back lane. We've got a mural out there, and we share the mural wall. The pub next door put some seating beside it. Yeah. So there's like a seating area that the pub and us share that's outside. And that's really nice because the front of the building is on a really noisy high street. So often for local people, it is quite noisy. But when you go to the back of the building, it's like super quiet. So it's quite a chilled out space at the back.
I'm also interested in how these spaces are obviously set up to be very open and welcoming, but even then can create exclusions in the process of trying to be inclusive. And how do you, you know, I guess that question of constantly, like, who isn't here, like, who isn't using this space, and how do you manage that or think through that with the group?
Probably our biggest conversation. So we have we've always had like a relational thing. So when we first moved there, we had a guy who a really like large guy who came in, and before he was in for 2 seconds, was explaining that he had a police record as a paedophile. So we just had to kind of be aware of that. So we were a bit like, oh, okay, what do we do with that? So we worked really hard, and we, you know, in that balance of confidentiality but safety. So we worked really hard as a community group to try and work that out. I think he's moved out of the area now, but I think we worked well with him. We've had a lady who half the community was accusing of taking all the stuff off the larger shelves and selling it down the local car boot sale. So we worked super hard in terms of how we would manage that and what we would do. And then we have another guy who has learning difficulties, but is really so he has no support worker or anything like that. He's a very large man in his like kind of late 50s. So he creates an emotional reaction in a lot of people. And we've really, as a group, so we are like diametrically opposed. So one extreme in our group would say, ban him! Yell at him every time, because he has a tendency to thieve as well. So he has a tendency to pick up anything that isn't nailed down. So one person would be like freaking out and banning, and then somebody else would be making him a cup of tea. So there's this like real difference. But actually what we find is that even though we don't always agree, well, we don't agree, that in itself is a good learning, because there's more than one person making the decisions. So it helps us kind of move forward and figure out what to do next. So having said that, there's another side of it that, so when we've actually stopped advertising the fact that we were doing drop-in art spaces. And the reason for that is that we were getting, so people who work in supported ways, so somebody would come with their support worker. The support worker would sometimes just sit on their phone, because, or they would explain to us they're not supposed to engage, they're just supposed to take somebody there. But then we had volunteers running arts groups, working with people with really complex needs and no experience or understanding, and that felt overwhelming as well. And so the way that we've managed that is that we won't ever turn anybody away, but we don't advertise this stuff. So we advertise like our small groups by word of mouth in this kind of very low-key mm-hmm. way, and that's why, really, because it felt a little bit overwhelming. But particularly I think because we didn't have to have the same like risk assessments as some other statutory places did coming out of COVID. So we had risk assessed and we were doing all the right things, but we were probably more open more quickly than some other organizations. And at that point, yeah, we had to be really mindful of how we managed the people that were in the room. And then, you know, and then apart from that, we it's actively part of our community ethos to help mix people up in the room. So, you know, we have some elderly people, we have some quite posh older people, we've got people who are, you know, who are begging on outside the co-op and or people who look, you know, very different, so they look like they might be homeless, even if they're not. And we're trying to really actively build relationships in those ways so people can start to connect with each other and start to make relationships, really. And that makes a huge difference. Mm-hmm. Because if you know somebody's name and you've spoken to them in a reasonably safe space, you're going to be less scared of walking past them in a dark night.
Yes, that is underpinning the whole project. I can get that. I've got like this. So one thing, there's almost like if you face questions about ways of working and what you're able, the limits of kind of the work you can do, it feels like you're working through that because of the underpinning methods of collaboration and discussion and sense checking that you've kind of built up together. So it's not like you've got one person having to make those decisions. You have that support through each other to discuss it. One of the, I guess, sort of a big difficult question or area of thinking about is the role that play that the Village Hub plays in the bigger picture of societal crises and all the news now about various bankruptcies of local authorities, of defunding of social care. And I'm just, obviously we have these questions in the arts and cultural sectors that work through community-based ways. Is this like, oh my goodness, are we just like picking up the pieces from a collapsing society? Are we, is that... are we being paid properly to do that? Do we have the skills and resources at hand to be able to do that well with other experts? But I guess that sort of bigger picture question about how, you see not just your work, but that kind of area of work in relation to the kind of what's happening with society. I mean, that's a really big question.
Super brilliant question. So absolutely. Absolutely, we sit on the point of collapse. I think we know that. It's dumb that we try and pretend that this is business as usual, because, and that's where my other job is really helpful. So everybody in high positions in the NHS, in the local authority, in the community work that the NHS is doing, everyone goes, it's a mess. It's like it's a massive mess. Education, yeah. So all of these really clunky pillars of society, really ridiculously struggling. And who knows? Who knows what the future will bring? Yeah, I think our position is that in order to be resilient, because generally what happens when there's a massive collapse, it's the poorest people who are the most affected. So, however, when COVID happened, actually working class or areas of poverty often did better than middle class areas, because they had within them, they had the links and the connections within the local neighborhood. And that's what we're trying to foster. So we're not trying to replace services, and we're not even thinking that, services are going to have to happen. I think, we feel the reality is there probably is still going to be a ridiculously long waiting list. The reality is that unless you can afford private healthcare in 5 years, you may never get your op. Yeah. So what are you going to do then? So I think what we're trying to do is kind of plan for that scenario and say, so what could we do as a bunch of random ordinary people with no specific skills to enable our neighborhood to like disaster proof itself, really? How could we eat? How could we keep warm? How could we share the skills with each other that we really need? How could we support each other? How could we care for our vulnerable members? How could we do all that in the worst case scenario? And if it's not that bad, you know, great, really great. And then I guess the other thing we're doing, which is slightly less dramatic than that, because, you know, I can't wander around preaching absolute devastation of society and Mad Max in the next 10 years. Yeah. But I mean, some people love that, not everyone. But the other thing that we're doing is we're trying to build really good relationships with all of those people who work in those institutions. So we're not like throwing the baby out with the bathwater, saying all the institutions are fundamentally corrupt and we don't want to work with them. We're trying really hard to hold those connections and to build with people who are still deeply embedded in the current system, but are still good people trying to do good work. And so we're trying to build these connections all the time. But rather than get them to do things for us, we're trying to build these kind of like equitable collaborations where people can come into the room. So whether you're just a local person with lived experience of anything, or whether you're a senior leader or a commissioner or somebody with a budget or whoever you happen to be, you can sit in the room as equal people and have a decent conversation. And that might be enough to start to kickstart solutions that are a little bit more thought through and intelligent than what is happening at the minute, which is basically that nobody knows what to do.
Yeah, that is such important work, Karen, isn't it? And long, it's the long game, isn't it? But I think what's so inspiring about it is that it is very process driven, and it has it's about the kind of approaches we take to building those relationships that are sustainable, that have longevity. I feel like something that another sort of area of interest is how things have become projects. I'm going to say projectified, but I don't even know if that's a word, but like everything's turned into a project. And I feel like that's also really, we've sort of accepted it in our lexicon, but I think it's we're realizing how damaging that is. When humans, we don't operate with those limits. And
so there's an acronym, isn't there, called FRAP, which is fix, repair, advise, protect. And it's a big no-no. Yeah, don't fix, don't repair, don't advise, don't protect. So it's like people are people, they have autonomy, they're not there to be fixed. And actually the potential solutions are often in somebody. Like if somebody can talk about things for long enough, very often it's like, oh yeah, you know what I should do? I should probably do that. And you go, yeah, that's a really good idea.
Come round to it eventually. We all come round to it.
Revelation has happened, and we're all like that. It's not, there's no, you know, higher people or lower people. The people are actually people. And the beauty of it is that, I have a really good friend who's had, you know, her history is that she's had numerous children taken into care and lost numerous children. And yet you would never think, do you know what I mean? She doesn't fit that profile. She's a remarkably caring, kind, intelligent person. And then I met another person recently who's actually talking to social workers who also had a child who was put up for adoption. But what she's done is, as her life has moved on, she's quite a lot younger. So systems are changing. We're not so kind of paternalistic anymore, or that authoritarian thing. And this younger woman is talking to trainee social workers about, this is the experience of the mum. Yeah. So if you're taking a child into care, this is what it feels like from. And I just go, that's really cool. One, my God, how brave is she to actually put herself forward like that? But also what a deeper understanding that can help social workers when they're actually having to have a relationship with somebody in that place, really, and they start to really understand how it feels and what it's like from the other side. So it's not perfect, yeah, but it feels like the repair of these places. So it would very traditionally be a massive break, yeah? So social workers are seen as the great big baddies who, you know, who are really awful and just take your kids off you if you're not careful. And then social workers would see people as, you know, poor parents or bad parents or be really concerned about the child's safety, yeah? So there's this, like, massive divide. So to begin to piece that together where people can actually relate in a human way and recognize that, you know, there's shortcomings on both sides, that feels like the best way to kind of build repair and build back trust again so we can start to do some of this work together. And it feels like that the only way you're going to do that is by actually getting those people to meet each other in the room. Yeah.
Absolutely. Karen, I'm aware we've been talking for at least half an hour, so we should bring it to a close now, but I feel obviously we've got a hell of a lot more to talk about. But we'll put all the links to the work you're doing in the show notes as well, and certainly continue the conversation, and I'll come and see you when I'm next down in Plymouth for sure. But yeah, thank you so much, Karen.
Oh, thank you, Sophie. It's really lovely to chat to you. And yeah, next time I think I should be the interviewer and you should be the interviewee, and I'm going to really hear what's going on in your side of things, because there's a lot and it's very beautiful, and I'm very happy to call you a friend.
Oh, thank you.
Now that you've heard the podcast, you can go to the website to find out more details, including references and links. The website's at miaw.net. That's miaaw.net. See you there.